Move to the fifth case, United States v. Brown.
May it please the court.
Deja vu.
Good morning again, Judge Tenor. I'm beginning to think you might live in that seat.
Just checking to make sure that was a different tie.
It is a different tie, but it is blue and red. Conformed with the court's rules. In this case, the government in the Northern District of Illinois once again pushed the conspiracy envelope. And when it did so, in this case, it took some calculated risks that aren't present in most other cases. And those were twofold. One is there were no fallback substantive counts in this case. Most of these buyer-seller cases, you'll see possession with the intent counts or delivery counts. Here there were money laundering counts, which the government dismissed. In addition, it did not call the two kingpins who could have clearly testified as to the circumstances of the arrangements between Mr. Brown and what has been called the Flores DTO. Instead, it called three couriers, Mr. Lamas, Mr. Perez, and Mr. Simmental. Their testimony was rather unique in terms of drug cases because they testified that they didn't talk to the people that they delivered the cocaine to. That in the transactions, essentially, they remained mute. They just didn't talk to the customers. That was on orders from the Flores twins. And the upshot of this is that these cooperating witnesses could not shed light on whether the cocaine was fronted or was on credit. They didn't negotiate with Mr. Brown. So the case is unusual in that regard. It's also unusual because we don't have Title III's in which you hear Mr. Brown talking to the Flores twins or talking.
Well, there was testimony, though, about picking up some funds, $26,000 or so, on one occasion when there was a delivery.
That was the last delivery.
And then there were other pickups of substantial sums of money, I think, into the millions of dollars?
Yes, no doubt substantial sums of money involved.
Without a word being spoken.
Right.
And then the deliveries were extremely large deliveries.
Extremely large.
40 kilograms in some instances.
Extremely large.
And then there were telephones delivered.
There were telephones delivered.
This is for personal use?
No, couldn't say it's for personal use. Couldn't even say it's for the big party that Judge Posner talks about in some of the cases. It's obviously for resale, but the fact that the sellers would know it's for resale under this court's cases is not enough. And the deliveries of money and the deliveries of cocaine were certainly separate. I think the reason for that is that you don't want to take the risk if there's an arrest, if there's a raid, a bust, whatever you want to call it, that both the product and the money is seized. But you can't say on this record that the payments did not occur before the delivery of cocaine. In fact, the first transaction between Brown and the DTO in this case was a transaction where Mr. Brown delivered money to one of the couriers.
But don't we get enough? I mean, Judge Tender was listing all the phones and everything else. Don't we get to a point where it's obvious that you don't have to say anything? You know what it's for.
I do not dispute that the sellers would know it was for resale in this case. But under the buyer-seller doctrine, that is not enough. There has to be some secondary agreement on behalf of the sellers to want to get involved in the buyer's business to distribute drugs.
Well, there's the situation, too, where some drugs were taken back. The product wasn't very good, I think, maybe on a couple of occasions.
On one occasion, early in the pattern here, some product was delivered. It was tied to Mr. Brown through fingerprints. And as this court stated in Nunez, the return of merchandise is a normal incident in a buyer-seller relationship. I go to Walmart and I return a product that was defective or I didn't like. I have not become a conspirator with Walmart, and that was the point of the Nunez case.
I wonder whether it might give rise to the inference that the Flores twins were interested in seeing Skinny's customers were satisfied so that his relationship with them would continue.
Well, there was no testimony as to this. They probably were interested in seeing that Mr. Brown was satisfied because he was a good customer. He was one of the best customers, but that's what he was. He was a customer. And it was the government's theory in this case that Mr. Brown, not that they proved some secondary conspiracy, which is what you usually see, that Mr. Brown, very unusual in this case, he's always alone. It's a one-man band with Mr. Brown. He's not, you know, in these cases where there's just a buyer-seller relationship, but the court finds something to uphold the conspiracy conviction, it's because the defendant came to the scene with another person, because the defendant interacted with another person in distributing drugs. We don't have this in the case. He's always alone when he meets these people. The fact that there were returns, that doesn't make it a conspiracy. It's a buyer-seller relationship. There was no evidence to say Mr. Brown's customers were unhappy with this product. And
at one point, didn't the Flores make some motor vehicle available to Brown so that he could, with a trap, so that he could, I would infer from that, so that he could transport his stuff without risk or with less risk of being.
That is true. I mean, there was testimony to that effect. But again, the testimony was that Mr. Brown ordered this vehicle. There was no testimony what the terms of this was. The government calls it a company car. Well, it's a real strange company car because no witness ever testified that Mr. Brown brought it to pick up drugs. No witness testified that Mr. Brown, it was an HHR vehicle, that he brought the HHR to deliver money. The car was ordered by Mr. Brown and then never seen again. Now, with a trap in it, of course, the inference is that you have a trap there to avoid detection from law enforcement. But that can be true in a buyer-seller. Nobody wants to get caught. In one of these cases, one of the recent cases, they talk about one of the defendants calling his supplier when he saw that there was police in the area. And the court held, well, that didn't make it a conspiratorial agreement. It's just interest in self preservation, and that's what's present in this case. Now, if the government had shown that Mr. Brown had taken this vehicle and used it to distribute drugs, then there would be, with other people, is part of an agreement, then there would be something there. But there was no evidence of that. He could have purchased this car. If the Flores brothers are seen as a distribution organization, just like Walmart, they can sell more than one product. It's interesting that on the last transaction, Mr. Brown brings $26,000. Now, $26,000 at that time couldn't even pay for a kilogram, according to the government's expert testimony. But it could, we would suggest, pay for a car. But the point is, we don't know what this money was for, and we don't know what the terms were for. Now, I've spent the last few days reading all this court's buyer-seller cases, and my eyes glazed over. And if they can be harmonized, then I'm not the person to say so. I see some distinctions in the case, some conflicts in the case. As I see it, the most recent cases seem to be saying that credit sales that are on a wholesale basis may give rise to a conspiracy. But that was not the law before, and that was not there are cases that say credit is not enough. And I think this court as a whole needs to speak to that issue if that can be done. I see I'm into my rebuttal, but I would like to just bring up the issue of the jury instruction.
We would like to speak with one voice on it. The problem is finding which voice to speak with.
I guess I won't respond to that, but I do see that in the cases. On the jury instruction, I will not prejudice Mr. Lucas with deliberations he was not privy to, but the committee just issued a jury instruction, and the court deviated from it in this case. It included the credit factor. So this opinion, if it affirms, is now saying that the court's jury instruction that was just recently created with a lot of effort is not good. It puts in the credit factor, which nudges the case in the government's favor, where there was no evidence to support it, and that's why it's prejudicial. And I'll reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Thank you. Lucas?
Thank you. May it please the Court, Brenton Lucas for the United States. Over the course of nearly 6 years and roughly 80 different transactions, the Flores twins provided the defendant with hundreds of kilograms of cocaine, multiple prepaid cell phones, and an SUV designed to facilitate the distribution of this cocaine. After reselling the drugs, the defendant in turn provided the twins with millions of dollars.
Well, how do we know the before and after? How do we know that it wasn't a prepay, as Mr. Martin suggests?
Your Honor, I think on a sufficiency challenge like the one we're facing here, both of these arguments were made before the jury. The government below argued that you could infer credit sales from the structure of the transactions, and the defendant in response said, you know, you could not infer credit sales because there was no discussion. I think, Your Honor, that given all the evidence in this case, including the structure of the transactions, and in particular the provision of this car, which was designed to facilitate the distribution of cocaine, that the jury was entitled to make this reasonable inference.
But if I recall, the first evidence was that there was a money pickup?
Yes, Your Honor. The first transaction discussed by one of the couriers was the defendant showed up, gave the courier a bag of money, and told him it was for either 12 or 22 kilograms of cocaine.
What about the Flores brothers? The opponent said something about it didn't call them. I assume, were they in the process of being prosecuted, or what was their status during this time?
Your Honor, while I'm not fully privy to all of the details because they're not on the record, based on my limited understanding of this matter, the Flores twins were cooperating and were involved in multiple different prosecutions ongoing at the same time, some involving Chicago-based distributors like the defendant, as well as some of the Mexico-based leadership. And the government in this case made a decision exercising its discretion that they thought the evidence here, the circumstantial evidence, was so overwhelming that there was no need to call the twins in this case.
Well, would quantity of drugs, this is probably larger than anything I've ever seen, is that a factor as far as what the evidence is concerned, just because of the strict, huge volume, that this had to be something much bigger than just that buyer?
Yes, Your Honor, we believe, and consistent with this Court's precedents, that the wholesale quantities of drugs, or hundreds and hundreds of kilograms of cocaine that were sold on credit, gives rise to an inference that there was an agreement to distribute these drugs down the line.
Now, is it clear they were sold on credit?
Your Honor, we think that is a perfectly reasonable inference for the jury to make, and the jury did make this, and on a sufficiency challenge, because this Court draws all reasonable inferences in the government's favor, we believe that inference is entitled to stand.
Okay, but there's obviously no evidence of his going somewhere and selling subsequently, which is obviously, how much did he take with him? What was the size of his normal purchase?
Your Honor, they ranged from 10 to 100 kilograms of cocaine.
So he's taking, well, whatever you want to call a hidden compartment full, he's taking an awful lot. And he's not going to build a brick house. He's going to do something with it. So I'm just wondering to what extent, with that being all we know, is that enough to imply for a jury to find preponderance of the evidence, or whatever you want to call it, beyond a reasonable doubt, obviously. Is that enough for the jury to conclude that it is he's definitely a seller as well as a buyer?
Your Honor, pure quantities alone, this Court has said on a number of times, is insufficient. But in this case, we think there is much more. In addition to the quantities involved, we also have this provision of an SUV that was designed to facilitate the distribution of cocaine further down the chain and get it out into the Chicago area. It came with a particular compartment, Your Honor. And that compartment, as testified by Lamas, the courier who gave this to him, was designed for the concealment of contraband, specifically drugs.
Well, that amount, I mean,
That amount, Your Honor, distributing massive amounts of drugs, as in this case. And, Your Honor, in addition to the evidence in this case, I know opposing counsel brings up that there is some confusion in this court's cases, but whatever confusion there is, whatever tensions there are, this case does not present them.
Talk here, about the instruction now?
The instruction, Your Honor.
Is that what you're referring to about the confusion?
I was referring to the fact that my opposing counsel raises points that this court's case law is somewhat unsettled in this area. I just wanted to address that, saying that whatever unsettled nature, whatever questions are left open, this case does not present them. This falls within the heartland of drug distribution conspiracies.
What's unsettled? There's a question of the instruction. What else is unsettled as far as you're talking about?
Your Honor, based on our reading, we can't see that much divergence. There have been some earlier pronouncements stating that, you know, perhaps a single credit sale would not be insufficient. But in this case, we have multiple sales of large quantities of cocaine on credit. In addition,
we know they're on credit. Is that right?
Your Honor, we think it's a reasonable inference that.
Again, nobody said that on credit or no. That's all I'm trying to do is know what we've got to go by reasonable inferences.
Yes, Your Honor. There was no direct evidence on credit. There was no statement that these sales were done on credit. But we believe that a jury was entitled to draw a reasonable inference based on the structure of the transactions. For instance, on one of the transactions, the defendant provided $26,000 and got 57 kilograms of cocaine. At that time, 57 kilograms of cocaine would be worth, at minimum, around $1.6 million. So this is clearly, these transactions are not being done a simple exchange of cocaine for money.
Are you suggesting an inference on an inference? That is, an inference that they were credit sales, and then a further inference that the credit sales were in furtherance of a conspiratorial agreement as opposed to a simple buy-sell?
Your Honor, I suppose that's one way you could possibly look at it, and I know that this court has been somewhat concerned with building inferences upon inferences, but in this case, we think the evidence is so overwhelming when considered in the totality that there's no concern of, you know, building a case out of sheer speculation. You know, we presented evidence to the jury, not only the nature of the transaction, the structure of exchanges of cocaine for large sums and then at completely different times, but also the provision of the SUV, which came with a compartment designed to conceal drugs that was used to distribute the cocaine through the Chicago area. And we think,
but for a good buyer, that's something you might do, is throw that in. The guy's buying hundreds of kilos. Give him a car to transport it around. Does that show an interest of the Flores in the success of Brown's subsequent sale?
Yes, Your Honor, we think it does, because Brown was just a mere buyer at that stage, and they, you know, invest tens of thousands of dollars into this vehicle and provide him. And the next day he stops buying from them. Well, then they're out a lot of money. And this shows that they've made an investment in this enterprise.
Do we know who is there evidence in the record that they're the ones that provided the secret compartment?
Yes, Your Honor. The vehicle came with a compartment. It was delivered, and the courier who gave the vehicle to the defendant actually showed him how to operate this compartment upon delivery.
And hadn't he ordered it up himself? Hadn't Brown said, been shown a similar one and said, I want one in black or something like that?
Yes, Your Honor, and he called the twins. All of the negotiations and discussions about how this enterprise was done came largely through the twins, and so Brown would call on his prepaid cell phones to the twins. They provided him the car outfitted with this particular compartment. And we believe that this is further evidence that this was not a mere buyer-seller relationship, Your Honor, but in fact a distribution conspiracy. Now, Your Honor, I would also like to address the jury instructions in this case and specifically respond to the defendant's argument that they are somehow similar to the 1999 instructions, which involved a multi-factor test. Your Honors, that comparison is unfounded. The old 1999 instructions involved an open-ended collection of various factors. This instruction, however, clearly set forth that you could convict based on sort of a relational contract approach, that if they showed an agreement to distribute and a mutual cooperation and support in furtherance of distributing those drugs, you could convict. And it gave as an example not as a factor, but as an example of this inference, that credit sales combined over a period of time, Your Honor, I see I'm out of time. May I finish?
Yeah.
Credit sales over a significant amount of time could be one inference of this transaction.
Who was, I've forgotten if it was in the record, who was the vehicle title to?
The vehicle title was, as far as I'm aware, Your Honor, it was not entitled into Brown's name, the specific SUV. I'm not 100% sure, but he did have insurance on that vehicle.
But we don't know who actually owned or had title to it from the record.
I'm not aware of it in the record, Your Honor. I may be mistaken, but I don't believe that specific vehicle was in the record. This court has no further questions. We respectfully request that it affirm the judgment below. Thank you.
Counsel, I think you were... Oh, you have one. I was going to say you were out of time, but you weren't.
Reserved a minute, I think. The government is essentially arguing for a large-scale drug buyer's exception to the buyer-seller doctrine. In this case, this court's cases say the opposite. If the linchpin now is credit, which it looks like that's where the law at least is heading, the government in its argument didn't point to any evidence of credit. They talked about reasonable inferences. But as this court stated in Johnson, when you're dealing with this kind of case, there has to be some kind of evidentiary foundation. It can't just be based on circumstantial evidence. And in this case, there was no evidentiary foundation for credit. It is speculation. It is piling of inferences. It is guessing. The defendant's a bad guy. He dealt a lot of drugs. It's a huge quantity. He's guilty of conspiracy. He might be guilty of something, but it's not conspiracy.
Do you know the answer to my question about the title of the vehicle?
Your Honor, I know the answer to the question, but it's not based on something in the record. But counsel is correct. The vehicle was insured in Mr. Brown's name.
But there is a title to another vehicle, isn't there, that shows up connected to Brown?
Yes, a 2005 Jeep was connected to...
Which also had a trap.
Which also had a trap.
It was used by others in the Flores organization.
Right, but there's
that
no...
That title shows up in the trash of Brown's house. At Brown's.
Right, there was a connection with that. There's no evidence to show Mr. Brown using that as part of a secondary agreement. If there are no further questions, thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.